from Clearfield to Westchester, Waynesburg to Breezewood, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has issued a landmark ruling upholding the rights of public sector workers not to be forced into paying fees to labor unions. Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center is here to discuss the ruling's impact on public employees in Pennsylvania. Helping elementary age students improve their math skills through hands-on interactive exhibits is the mission of Archie's Math. Joe Geiger has Jim Bunning of Archie's Math in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And for the first time in 4 years, Pennsylvania has an on-time state budget. Who deserves credit? Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity in Pennsylvania tells us on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. A bipartisan effort sponsored in the state Senate by Republican gubernatorial nominee Scott Wagner and signed into law by Governor Tom Wolf now automatically seals misdemeanor records, giving a clean slate to low-level offenders. Those records will be sealed so long as the individual has gone 10 years with no additional violations. There are some exceptions, though. Serious offenses involving firearms, cruelty to animals, corruption of minors, and some other categories would not be sealed, nor would records be sealed for defendants who have a prior felony conviction. The new law also seals records of arrests that did not result in a conviction. In what is usually a divided legislature, the bill passed the Senate unanimously. There were only two no votes in the state House. Such records often were a barrier to individuals seeking jobs or taking other steps to reintegrate into society. State Representative Eli Ivankovic, who represents a western Westmoreland County district, has announced he will resign at the end of the summer to take a job in the private sector with a manufacturing company. Murraysville Mayor Robert Brooks secured the Republican nomination to succeed Ivankovic in last May's primary, while 22-year-old Jonathan McCabe will be the Democrat standard bearer. Given the fact Ivankovic's term expires in just a few months, a special election is unlikely. Good news for taxpayers in Cambria County. A new audit shows that for the first time since 2011, the county does not have a general fund deficit. The audit also showed the county's pension plan is relatively healthy. Moreover, in each of the past 2 years, county commissioners have voted to decrease taxes by half a mil. Refinancing of long-term debt to lower rates is being credited in helping to restore fiscal health to county's finances. Read about all things Pennsylvania at the all-new patownhall.com. No longer must public sector employees pay fees to a labor union as a condition of holding their job. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down a landmark ruling in June upholding the constitutional right of workers to decide for themselves whether or not to support a labor union. Nathan McGrath is vice president and litigation counsel at the Fairness Center. He is here with details on the ruling and to discuss its impact on public employees in Pennsylvania. Nathan, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Nathan, before we talk about the impact of the Janus ruling in Pennsylvania, for those who may not have heard about it, although it's been covered rather extensively by the news media, tell us what Janus v. AFSCME was all about, and then we'll talk about how the Supreme Court ruled.
Mark Janus is a state employee in Illinois, and he works as a child support specialist. And what he did was he brought this lawsuit, and he argued essentially that all union activity, even collective bargaining, is political and that it's compelled speech. And so he brought his lawsuit, and his lawsuit seeks to overrule a case from 1977 called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And in that ruling, the Supreme Court in 1977 had said it's okay to charge non-member employees for what they term collective bargaining expenses.
That case worked its way up to the Supreme Court. A similar case came before the court a year or two ago, and deadlocked 4-4 because we were down a justice. Now, of course, Justice Neil Gorsuch is on the bench. So what did the court rule, the Supreme Court of the United States, finally in Janus versus AFSCME?
The Supreme Court ruled in Mr. Janus's favor. My summary of the holding was, first, they said that compelling union fees from a non-consenting, non-member employee is unconstitutional. It's a violation of his First Amendment rights. Secondly, the court went further and scrapped the holding in Abood. They just flat out said that was incorrect, and we're going to do away with Abood. Abood is overruled. And then, interestingly, they plopped in kind of at the very back of their opinion. Everyone was wondering about an issue called an opt-in, opt-out issue, and that's where employees have to, it's been the law that they have to opt out, meaning they have to affirmatively say, we don't want to pay fees to the union. And what the court said there was actually it should be an opt-in, and the unions need to receive from a non-member employee affirmative consent and clearly demonstrating that they actually want to pay the union fees instead of it being assumed that they want to pay. So that was a really big deal. A lot of people were wondering whether the court would touch that opt-in, opt-out issue, and indeed they did.
Does this then, in effect, make the entire country right to work? We had roughly half the states that were right to work, half that weren't. Does this pretty much de facto make the whole country a right to work country?
This case dealt with the public sector. And so now there is a national precedent that public sector non-member employees can't be forced to pay these fees. And while this, the holding technically just goes to Mark Janus, in effect, public sector employees across the nation can now begin to claim, I guess, what they're going to call their Janus rights. And that would, national precedent obviously applies across the nation. So they can, employees in all these different states can start asking for the Janus rights.
Now, let's talk specifically, Nathan, about Pennsylvania. There is a case the Fairness Center has been pursuing, Hartnett versus PSEA, that is directly related to all of this. So first of all, tell us, who is Hartnett? What is that case all about?
We represent four public school teachers. Greg Hartnett is the lead plaintiff, and he's a teacher over in Homer Center School District, art teacher, great guy. And our four clients, these four school teachers, they have all said, we don't want the union representing us. We don't want to pay them any compelled fees as a condition of our employment. And they came to us, and we actually filed a lawsuit on their behalf against PSEA and the local unions that represent them. And it actually brought before the court the exact same issue here in Janus, whether it's constitutional or in a violation of their First Amendment rights to compel them to pay fees to a union as a condition of their employment. So the Janus decision is right on point with our client's case as well here in Pennsylvania.
Is this case in federal court or is it in the state courts?
It is in the federal court. It's in the Middle District of Pennsylvania right now.
So it being in the federal court, then my assumption as being not an attorney, and I know assumptions are always a dangerous thing.
they are.
would be that the federal courts would all be bound by a decision that has been rendered by the Supreme Court?
Yes. Ultimately, lower federal courts, if there's a Supreme Court ruling on a particular issue, and if it's not distinguishable in any way, they are bound to follow the Supreme Court's lead on that.
So what is the next step in the Hartnett versus PSEA suit?
Right now, the parties are working together to put a joint notice together to file with the court, basically to tell our judge in our client's case, hey, the Janus case has been decided, here's the opinion, and we're going to get together and discuss next steps and the impact that Janus has on the case and how the parties are going to proceed.
We are talking with Nathan McGrath. He is Vice President and Litigation Counsel with the Fairness Center. We've been discussing the Janus versus AFSCME ruling handed down a week or so ago by the Supreme Court of the United States and its impact on a similar case here in Pennsylvania, Hartnett versus PSEA, all this having to do with forcing workers to pay fees to labor unions when they do not want to do so. So now, Nathan, we have, what, about 300,000 government workers in Pennsylvania? Is it going to be automatic that they will have their so-called Janus rights now, or are suits like Hartnett going to be necessary in a variety of different venues in order to make sure that workers are able to exercise the right that they now have been given?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question and something that we're paying close attention to. So the Janus decision was handed down, and it's a Supreme Court precedent, but that doesn't mean that it's automatic. In fact, we're watching to see what public employers are doing, what public unions are doing. So are they looking at the Janus decision saying, hey, we're going to take action on our own and we're going to stop these fees because we now know that they're unconstitutional and we're not allowed to take them? Or is it going to take a case like Hartnett and other cases around the Commonwealth here to actually enforce people's Janus rights? I suppose that's something that we're only going to know in the future. However, we do look at the Hartnett case as an enforcement type case now to ensure that our clients and other public school teachers, for that matter, receive their Janus rights.
Let's talk a bit about the liability that public sector labor unions now have in all of this. And the one thing that I was wondering is, in view of the fact that we now have any number of workers, exactly what the number is, I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. The number of workers who have been forced to pay these fees to labor unions, and now it's been clear that their constitutional right has been violated. Is there a period of time for which they can now go to labor unions and ask for a refund?
This, too, is an interesting question, and it may be a real problem for the unions. Typically, when you get a Supreme Court case like this, it's forward-looking, and you can't always go backwards necessarily, especially if a party was relying on what they would call as good law. But something very interesting in the Janus opinion, Justice Alito actually started talking about how these unions should have been on notice, really, and he specifically goes back to the Knox v. SEIU case and the Harris v. Quinn case and talking about the Friedrichs v. CTA case, which you mentioned earlier, which ended in a split decision because of Justice Scalia's passing. And all of that to say that the unions, at least the union's lawyers, should have been on notice that this day was probably coming, especially through what he wrote into the Harris opinion and the Knox opinion, really questioning whether Abood was good law. So I would say, arguably, there may be a case to be made that these non-members who have had money deducted from their paycheck now for many, many, many years may be able to look back a few years, at least to Harris, maybe Knox, and to be able to get some of that money back. I don't know the answer to that, I have to say this, but I would say that arguably maybe there's something to be done there.
Say hypothetically I were a public employee and I was paying these fees, but I didn't really want to. What do I do now?
We would love to hear from you here at the Fairness Center. We actually offer free representation to those who are hurt by public sector union officials. And so this would definitely qualify if you have any questions about fees, if you should be paying, what should be happening next. And you can contact us at fairnesscenter.org or 844-293-1001.
And again, the Fairness Center, we have been talking with their vice president and litigation counsel, Nathan McGrath. Again, if we have folks who are interested, who may possibly need your services, where again can they get in touch with you?
They can go to our website, it's fairnesscenter.org, or they can give us a call at 844-293-1001.
Nathan McGrath of the Fairness Center. Nathan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Helping students learn math through hands-on interactive exhibits is the goal of Archie's Math. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Jim Bunning of Archie's Math in the Community Benefit Spotlight.
Thank you, Loman, and thank you, Jim, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program. Jim, would you share with the listeners a little bit about Archie's Math, a new organization, catchy name? What is Archie's Math?
First, Archie's Math is named after Archimedes, who is our hero math wizard from 2,000 years ago. And Archimedes developed a lot of the principles and geometric formulas that we use today. So for a math program, we thought it would be a good idea to call it Archie's Math. And what we are is an outreach program. We take interactive exhibits to schools and youth groups. And the exhibits demonstrate, you mean, the math principles that the kids are learning in school, K through 6. And we have about 20 pop-up exhibits, which are tabletop exhibits, and each exhibit explains one of the basic math principles the kids are learning. So it's geometry and place value and all the PA core standards. And in Pennsylvania, you know, we have very specific math principles that the kids have to learn. And so what we do is we enable the kids with interactives, which the educators call these manipulatives. The kids actually manipulate the exhibits and the interactives to understand how the math principle works. So that's what we do. We load up about 20 hands-on exhibits. We go to a school. We put the exhibits out on tables. The kids come in. Each exhibit is tied directly to a PA math standard. And, you know, people talk about, well, these exhibits are aligned with standards. Our exhibits actually demonstrate the principle that the kids are learning. So we've got algebra, numbers and operations, geometry, measurement, data, probability. A little background here. The beauty of this is kids learn by touching and doing. And other countries have high math proficiency, and in this country we have poor math proficiency. As a developed country, we rank 44th in math proficiency with our kids. And the reason is that we continue to teach in this country math the way we always have, which the educators call drill and kill, which is these poor kids have to memorize formula, recite the formula back, and if they recite it correctly, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, then they get a grade without understanding really what that math formula means in the real world. So, you know, what does that mean? What does it look like? How do I use it? And the reason our country scores poorly is that our kids are memorizing. It's just rote memorization of symbols and formulas and numbers rather than understanding how the math is used in the real world, how it's used to solve problems, how it's used to think qualitatively. When you think about it, in this country we have chemistry labs, but we don't have math labs. Other countries have math labs, so the kids will, you know, read the math book and then they go to the math lab and they work through the problems with manipulatives. We don't do that. So that's what we do. It's kids learn by doing, and they understand how it works physically. Their hands understand it, their minds, their eyes understand what's happening, how it works in the real world, and then they can understand the math that they're learning.
So we've taught math like this for a long time in the United States. What was the inspiration to say this isn't working and to do it differently?
I was involved with the startup of a science center, and it was a hands-on science center. And I saw that kids, when they would actually do an activity, they could understand the concept. And as I got into that, I realized that maybe the same thing, maybe interactives, manipulatives could explain math. And when I researched, I said, son of a gun, this is how other countries teach math. They have kids come into the math lab, and they actually do the exercises and understand the math. So I read about it, and I researched it, and I visited science centers, and I found that there were traveling math labs in other states in this country. In North Carolina, they have some good ones. In Minnesota, they have some good ones. And so the more I learned, the more I realized that this is pretty basic learning. And the educators that I talk with say that, yep, we need more manipulatives. That's what they call them, manipulatives, to explain this stuff to the kids. So it's not just what they call drill and kill. You're drilling these formula into the kid and then killing any interest or really any understanding of how it relates to the real world. Just one thought. The other countries who do well in math teach with math labs and manipulatives, and the reason it works for them is the kids understand how the math works in the world, how they can use it, you know, how you can use it to solve problems or be creative. We don't do that. We just ask the kids to memorize the formula. So as I learned about it, I said, gosh, this is a big deal here, and we're missing the boat. And so we're just starting with Archie's Math to have a program that can go into the schools and the kids can experiment and learn.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Jim Bunting, the president of an organization called Archie's Math. So, Jim, what has surprised you about the reception of this program as you take it to the schools? Are the schools pretty receptive?
Very much so. They want manipulatives. They don't have much money, but the budgets are slim. A couple of surprising things. We knew it's the right way to do it, but a thing that surprised me was that when the kids, for example, the kids are building a geometric sphere out of hexagons and pentagons. So they really are a little hesitant to start, and they think, gee, am I going to screw this up? Am I going to fail? Well, nobody fails here, and so you help the kid a little bit, and you say, all right, now let's not, no two pentagons go next to each other. And son of a gun, the kid builds this beautiful geodesic sphere. It's beautiful. And the kid holds this up and look what I did. And that's, it's a wonderful thing to see, because the kid has accomplished something. The kid can see it. The kid realizes that they're a smart kid. But one of the unfortunate things with math is a lot of kids become discouraged at an early age, and they say, gee, I'm not good at math, I'm not very smart.
There the kids are sitting there saying, when am I ever going to use this in the real world?
That's exactly right. It's exactly right. And so the thrill for us and the kids is their achievement. The success of this program is the kids see math as, it's not a mystery, it's not boring, it's a terrific, it's a beautiful science, and they're achievers.
Jim, if people want to learn more about Archie's Math, where can they find you?
Well, we have a little website called archiesmath.org, and it just shows some of the activities with some photos, and it explains what we're doing.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Jim Bunting, the president of Archie's Math, a new way to teach math to students in the United States. Jim, thank you for being a guest on the program.
Thank you very much.
Taxpayers in Penns Woods can breathe a bit easier this summer. The legislature has passed a new fiscal year budget on time and without hiking taxes. On this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity provides details. Anna?
In 1777, Samuel Adams coined the phrase, give credit to whom credit is due. In politics, this phrase is totally forgotten by many looking to take credit for something no matter how little impact they had on the outcome. I guess it's the nature of the game, and I'm sure it's been happening since Adams' days. Today, I'd like to give credit to whom credit is due, PA Budget Edition. The fiscal year 2018-19 Pennsylvania state budget is in the books before the deadline for the first time since Governor Corbett was in office. It also contained no tax increases, which is a first since the longest budget impasse to date, the 2015-16 fiscal year budget. Many legislators have sent out newsletters lauding the budget and patting themselves on the back for a job well done. Unfortunately, they don't acknowledge in the past two budgets, each of which included a tax increase. The 2016-17 budget virtually eliminated an entire industry with its crushing tax on small vaping businesses. Nearly 140 shops have closed their doors, many within the first year that tax was enacted. That year, the majority of legislators also voted to increase taxes on gaming and other industries by $1.3 billion. It was the first budget that I clearly remember legislators taking the position that if an activity isn't expressly made legal by law and taxed, then it is an illegal activity, guilty before being proved innocent. The 2017-18 budget included $1.5 billion in borrowing and a 12% tax on fireworks. It was a second kick-the-can-down-the-road approach to budgeting with which Pennsylvanians are all too familiar. It's interesting that legislators' glowing email didn't mention any of those issues with the past two budgets when they talked about growing the economy and putting money into the rainy day fund for the first time since Ridge was governor. Let's give credit to whom credit is due. Without Congress passing and the president signing the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and without everyday Pennsylvanians launching businesses and doing what they can to rev up the economy, we wouldn't have the small economic growth in Pennsylvania that we're now experiencing. On top of this series of patchwork budgets, the Pennsylvania General Assembly has not passed, and the governor has not signed, any meaningful reforms that would have an impact on our economy like the way the Tax Cut and Jobs Act has. State Director Beth Ann Mumford wrote a letter to the legislature outlining what we would like to see and not see in the budget package of bills. One, we'd like to see regulatory reform. The package of regulatory reform bills, including the RAINS Act, making its way through the legislature, would eliminate or ease excessive regulations that hinder Pennsylvania's economy from unleashing its potential. reduce spending. Lawmakers need to stop spending money we don't have on programs we don't need, particularly on corporate welfare programs that benefit the well-connected few at the expense of hardworking Pennsylvanians. While some line items are reduced, overall, this budget continued to increase spending. If they aren't going to reduce spending, at the very least, they should enact the Taxpayer Protection Act to constrain governmental growth and match the economic growth of the Commonwealth. 3, lawmakers should stop negotiating budgets behind closed doors, even out of sight from their own members of the appropriations committees. The opaque budget process lacks transparency and accountability. Taxpayers deserve more say and insight into how their money is being spent. Finally, reject new taxes or increase taxes. We have spent 3 years advocating against the passage of a second tax on the shale industry, gross receipts taxes that act like a sales tax on your energy bills, and against increases in the personal income tax and sales and use tax. We're thankful that taxes were not increased, but that is simply because the growth in the economy by the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and that the legislature borrowed $1.5 billion in the previous budget to help wipe $2 billion deficit off the books. Due to the single subject clause of our state constitution, language of these regulatory reform bills could not be put into one of the official code bills that's part of the budget. However, leadership could have made the choice to pass these and put down the marker of reform, even knowing that the governor may not sign them. We know that the 4 budget goals will work because we've seen it in other states. Wisconsin and North Carolina revamped their economic policies, cut taxes, and reform spending, and today are enjoying balanced budgets and real revenue surpluses, not surpluses caused by congressional action alone and massive borrowing. More importantly, their economies are growing and their people are working instead of fleeing to other states for employment. About 8,000 workers between the ages of 18 and 40 are leaving Pennsylvania every year. If we don't turn this around, in 10 years, we'll have nearly 1 million less in taxpayers than today. You can't grow an economy like that. Lawmakers can unlock the real promise of Pennsylvania with a true commitment to fiscal responsibility and dynamic economic growth. We look forward to working with like-minded individuals and their legislators toward putting the Commonwealth's finances on a path toward greater economic prosperity and promise. Credit to whom credit is due. Lawmakers did well this budget season to complete the plan on time and prevent tax hikes. The Pennsylvania General Assembly's Common Sense Caucus, similar to Congress's Freedom Caucus, has done yeoman's work inside the building to influence their leadership to keep spending down. But the lack of meaningful reforms will continue to harm Pennsylvanians and threaten to take us further from the path to prosperity. I'm Anna McCausland, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania. Like us on Facebook by searching for Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania. Follow us on Twitter at AFP Pennsylvania and visit our website, AmericansForProsperity.org.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 23 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WTYM-AM in Katanning, WNTP-AM, and WFIL-AM in Lafayette Hill, along with WLSH-AM in Lansford, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.